This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
Hi, regular listeners, you may have spotted that we've changed our name. It's now Honey & Co. The Food Sessions.
So if you hear this sound, it's just us making dinner.
Well, that and the fact that we're not allowed to use our old title anymore.
It's just been a bit of a thing, but don't worry about it.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, I'm Sarit Becker.
I'm Itamar Srulovic. Together we run a couple of Middle Eastern restaurants in London.
And we also do our fair share of food writing. And welcome to Series 6 of Honey & Co. It's a series of talks we host in our little deli, Honey & Spice, on Warren Street. We talk to chefs and cookbook writers and waiters and managers and people we admire from the world of food.
This season we got to meet some incredible people. We've cooked their food. We've learned so much. We are so excited to share this with you. I hope you enjoy as much as we did.
Tonight we're joined by New York Times columnist, cookbook writers, and all-around great girl, Alison Roman. She just had a new book come out called Nothing Fancy, and it is fancy. Well, not in the usual sense. It's just a great book. She's a great, great writer and terrific recipes. We had a night of very weird and wonderful conversation. We've apologized to leaks. We changed our mind about rice. We talked a lot about anchovies and a lot about cheese and imaginary friends. We had a terrific night. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Alison Roman, people.
Yay!
Alison, of course, we know her from her column in the New York Times, from her funny, witty rye videos. The fingernails.
Yeah,
the big deal. The wonderful food. You know, and we have all these dishes with the, you know, the dip, the chicken, the cookies.
That's right, yeah.
The Alison Roman. With her second book, Nothing Fancy, which is nothing fancy, but it's so great. It's so wonderful. It was just a delight spending time with this book. I've had it by my bed for the last week, and my wife is like, "What's with the Alison? What's going on there?" Like,
yeah.
But everybody knows that my heart belongs to our Danish rice sourdough starter.
No other. No, well, that's right. The book can't compete.
There's no room for another woman.
Cannot compete.
Sorry.
Yeah. Erica is the rice star.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's foremost in my mind. But second is Alison Roman.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So you kind of, you know, feels like you've always been around, but actually, you know, your first book came out last year? Or
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Here and here it came out this year.
Yeah.
In the UK.
Yeah.
But it came out in 2017.
Yeah, and that was kind of, you know, suddenly Alison Roman was everywhere, and, you know, the New York Times, but tell us your origin
story. Where I came from.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
It's
everything
yeah.
that happened from the moment that you were born.
Oh my God. Buckle up, people. This is going to be, yeah.
This is going to be.
That's what I save my therapist for.
Yeah.
We don't need to do that here. But yeah, it's funny to hear people say, I hear a lot they'll talk about me and say, oh, you came out of nowhere. Like, all of a sudden, it's like you're just on the scene. And I'm like, I have been working in food for 15 years. So overnight seems a bit of a stretch. But yeah, so I got my start working in restaurants and I dropped out of college to go work in restaurants because I thought that was a good idea.
You were studying writing? I was.
I was in college for writing, but not necessarily specifically. I wasn't like, I'm going to be a writer. It was more I enjoyed writing and figured that I would try to do something in school that would help foster, you know, some creativity or make me get better at the things that I already liked doing. And when I realized I was spending all of my time reading cookbooks and, you know, teaching myself how to cook at home, I thought that maybe my time would be better spent working in a restaurant. I thought, oh, I can always go back to college. I didn't go back. But my parents, as you can imagine, were thrilled and less than supportive.
Great.
Yeah, they were like, you're going to work in the kitchen. And this was 15 years ago. So I feel like at the time, working in a restaurant and being a chef and whatever wasn't as alluring or sexy as it is now, where food is such a part of our lives and our conversation, where when someone says, oh, I own a restaurant or I'm a chef, you're like, that is so cool. And when I said that at the time, it was not quite the response. It was like, you work in a kitchen? Like, what?
Like, it's like, you're a junkie.
Yeah, exactly. Or that, like, I failed out of college and now all the work I could get was in a kitchen. Or, like, it was very hard for people to wrap their minds around that that was something that really spoke to me and I wanted to pursue. And so I literally knocked on the back of the door of a restaurant and was
Which one?
It was called Sona in Los Angeles. And I was like, can I speak with the chef? And they were like, who are you? I was like, just a person who likes this restaurant. And the chef wasn't there, but the pastry chef was. And so I ended up speaking with the pastry chef and saying, I'm going to go to culinary school. I was wondering if I could work here part-time while I'm in school just to, you know, pay for the culinary school. And he was like, listen, culinary school is garbage. I will give you a job and pay you $7 an hour to cut marshmallows and see if you like it, because chances are you won't. He was basically like, most people that get a job in a restaurant are like, what the hell have I done with my life?
Yeah.
And they are like, I just wasted $50,000 and, you know, whatever.
He
was very kind. He did me a huge favor. So I ended up not going to culinary school. I got a job with him and fell so in love with it. And I was so bad at it. I cried every day, all the time. But I loved going back and I loved learning about it. And I loved the pressure. I loved the energy of working a service in a restaurant. And I was so obsessed with getting better because of how bad I was when I started, which, like, any amount of improvement would have been better because it was, like, truly a nightmare.
Rock bottom,
and just extremely thankful for all the mentors I had that put up with me and saw that I was enthusiastic enough to want to spend time on me. Like, they're like, well, she's shit, but, you know, she really wants it. So we can help her try to get better.
This is what I find, you know, the restaurants are very accepting environments. Mm-hmm. That you'd say, it's not like, oh, yeah, I landed a job in this and that restaurant. You never land. Like, you have a pulse, you're in, you're hired.
Yeah, exactly.
You come back the next day, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and as a person who's worked in a restaurant, I'm sure you can back this up, but if you come in and you're complaining about work, and even if you are good, you don't want them to be in your restaurant. But if you're bad and you really care and you want to learn, there's a chance you're going to be like, okay, let's make this work.
Yeah.
So that was me, the bad person who cared a lot. And so I worked in restaurants for about 6 or 7 years. I lived in San Francisco, worked at a restaurant there, moved to New York.
Which one?
It was called Quince. Still is called Quince.
I've been to their wine bar place thing.
Yeah, I haven't made it there yet.
What's it called?
It's called Verjus.
Verjus, yeah.
I haven't been yet.
Nice.
Yeah, they do
really
a lovely job.
They
really have done a wonderful thing for San Francisco. Yeah. But that was sort of that was the last restaurant, fine dining restaurant I worked at. I was like, can't do this anymore. And it was in that time where I realized, well, I don't want to run my own kitchen and I don't want to own my own restaurant and I don't want to work for somebody else for the rest
smart
of my
girl,
life.
Smart girl.
So,
smart girl. Yeah.
I mean.
Tick, tick, tick.
But I was like, but I love food. It's all I've ever done. It's the only job I've ever had. How do I continue to work in food but not do any of those things that I just mentioned? So I moved to New York for 3 months. Just because I had grown up in California, it was all I had ever known. I was like, I live in California. I'm going to die in California. It's the only state that matters. I love it here. And a month and a half into living in New York, I had gotten a job at Momofuku. I was doing desserts for Milk Bar and for Sambar and for Co. And they're like, we're going to make you a manager. Here's health insurance and a salary. And I was like, well, I'm living here now forever, I guess. And that was 10 years ago. So, but I really fell deeply in love with it in a way that I didn't expect to.
With the town, with the work, with the package?
With New York. Yeah, New York has always been so good to me. And I think that I really kind of thrive in an energy, I mean, not unlike London, where, and that's why I like London so much, but it feels super alive and like really challenging. But I think that if you're the kind of person that thrives in a challenge, or, you know, kind of enjoys the good with the bad, or I feel like you can't have good without bad, I feel like it's just super dynamic and I love it. And so I've been there. And after about a year and a half at Milk Bar, I had helped Christina.
Which this is, you know, like still is now, but then was the place. It was,
yeah, it was a baby bakery. Only. Yeah, it was. They had just opened. When I started at Milk Bar, it was about as big as this room and the kitchen was half the size. And we shared it with Sambar and they were so mean to us. And it was unbelievable. But I had come from this like really high intense pressured fine dining restaurant with tasting menus, and we were making our own breads and our own petit fours, and it was just the level of service and things. I was managing three people and working from 10 a.m. until 2 a.m. and it was really intense. And so I was thinking, oh, what a dream to work at a bakery where you are, you know, you come in at 8 a.m. and you leave at 4. And I was like, I had no idea what to do with myself because I had free time, which was a foreign concept.
What you do is go that to didn't bed last at
long. Yeah, that didn't last long.
You wake up at 6 a.m.
Exactly. Yeah, they moved me over, and then all of a sudden I was again working 12 hours a day. And I thought, okay, that's not why I moved to New York. So I quit. I had helped Christina Tosi with the first Milk Bar cookbook, and in that process, I was sort of like, oh, that's an interesting thing. Like, yeah. You can write a recipe, test it, make sure it works for a home cook, and then put it in a book, and that's cool. And it was the first time that I had even considered that to be an option for me. And so pretty severely, in the way that I make all my decisions, I was like, well, I'm quitting and I'm writing cookbooks. I mean, it didn't happen for many years after that, but I met with an editor at Bon Appetit magazine, and then he interviewed me to work in their test kitchen, and he's like, have you ever tested a recipe before? And I was like, oh yeah, absolutely. I had not. I definitely had not done that. But I figured that working in a kitchen, being a chef, in whatever capacity, you're kind of always recipe testing, right? Yeah. Like, you are testing a recipe to make sure it works for your staff and for the cooks and for to be consistent night after night. So it wasn't unsimilar. And then combined with the actual testing I had done for the Milk Bar book, I felt like I was qualified to say yes and not be a total lie.
Yeah. Also, it's not, you know, it's an exacting work, but if you can cook, you can do it.
Yeah. And I think that the translation between being a professional cook and a home cook, because I had never really been a home cook because I had worked so damn much. I didn't have time to cook at home. And I feel like it's so funny when I read interviews and people ask chefs, like, what's your favorite meal to make at home? And they're always like, a pot of rice with an egg on it. That is all I have time for, and that's all I ever make for myself. And I feel similarly. But, you know, so thinking about the home cook at this stage in my career was really interesting because I hadn't really done that before. But part of that job at Bon Appetit was also taking recipes from chefs and restaurants and then translating them to work in the magazine for a home cook. And so it was in that process that I really learned, like, okay, what kind of equipment? Okay, they say use this kind of pan. I know they mean a hotel pan, which no home cook has. How can I convert that to a 9x13 baking dish or whatever? Like, using sort of cognitive thinking about writing recipes, and then...
Which is, it's a really, actually a great skill.
Yeah.
Like, and you learn a lot in the process.
Yeah, I felt really challenged by it. And I think that was the other reason why I left restaurants. I wasn't feeling challenged intellectually anymore. I felt like, you know, the adrenaline rush you get from performing service and like executing the dishes and doing it again the next night is addicting. But I found myself not being necessarily fulfilled by it anymore. And so wanted to figure out how to go beyond that. And I think in my time at Bon Appetit, I realized that more than just feeding people directly, I really wanted to teach people how to cook and like feed them that way. And so after about a year of just being a recipe tester, they started letting me make my own recipes. And with that came more writing. And my writing at first was so bad. Again, much like my beginning at a kitchen, it was just really horrible.
Your writing is so good. Your writing is so good.
Well, it's interesting because I think I was so nervous of being myself at first. And that's why it was so bad. Because I was like writing as if I were leaving my body and pretending to be a magazine writer, whatever I thought that meant. And it wasn't good. Who would be, you know, if you're pretending to be somebody else? And the more I had time spent with editors who were like, you need to relax, just be yourself. Just write it as you're speaking. Because when you tell me this thing, it sounds funny and interesting. But when you write it, it sounds awful. So do less of that and more of that. So as soon as I learned how to just kind of go back to where I started, which was before college even, and the writing I had done, which was very much just my voice, I found it to be more successful. The magazine writing was still more challenging, but when I sat down to write Dining In, which was the first time I had really written my own book, obviously because it was my first book, I was shocked at myself at how easily it came. And even with Nothing Fancy, like I joke, Nothing Fancy especially could have been twice as long because I had so much to say and was writing so easily. I'm not saying it was all good because a lot of it got cut, which probably means it wasn't, but I was so enthusiastic on the subject. And when I'm writing about something like steaming broccoli, I get so pumped and like I genuinely am excited and I have a lot to say.
There's just so much. It just gushes out of you, and it feels there's something about it that's very contemporary and now, but actually you can see links to, you know, food writing of you know, Ruth Rakel and you know, Nora Ephron here and
that's
the big guns.
That's extremely flattering. Thanks.
It is, because I thought, like, there's such good lines here that I just didn't know what to choose. But I have this, this is the wonderful recipe for a sausage party.
Yeah.
Not what you think, guys. It's not that kind of book.
I had that line and my editor cut it. They were like, we don't need to say that.
But I have to say, just like one line, I was once dumped the morning after a meatball forward meal, and yes, I blame the meatballs. Just like these little things. But it's just so funny and witty and capture a little feeling and make you laugh.
Thank you.
But there is a lot of emotion about food as well. You offer an apology to leeks.
I am sorry to them.
Yes. Yeah.
I feel like because I've been in food for so long, there's nothing about my life that isn't involved in food. And that includes like my relationships and ingredients and stories and anecdotes. And I felt like in order to do a book for me, I had to be myself and in order for it to be original, because these days I feel like anyone can write a cookbook, and a lot of people do. And there's a lot of cookbooks out there.
Yeah.
And to look at them in a sea of each other, you're kind of like, okay, well, why this one? Why would I buy this one instead of this one? And the conclusion I drew was like, you're going to have to like and trust the person. So A, the recipes have to work. You have to trust them. You have to like the recipes in order to trust them, and they have to work in order for you to trust them. But the other thing is you have to want to hang out with them. Reading a book like this is like you're hanging out with that person for a long time.
Yeah.
And so you have to want to spend time. And believe me, there are more people in this room than not that like double the amount that do not like me. And I've learned that. And that's fine. And not everyone's going to like me. But I feel like the ones that do really do. So I'm appreciative of that. But, you know, being yourself and being as much yourself as you're allowed, while at the same time offering service to, like, here's why you're roasting your chicken that way, but also this funny story to go along with it, to me was important.
I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what makes this book so charming and so appealing. And it is like we all have our, you know, set of friends, and our friends are rubbish, for example. And you kind of, you know, you take them as they are and you...
I hear you.
Yeah. But this is kind of what you want your friends to be. You want them to be easy and funny and to have delicious food for you, but, you know, also messy and, you know, to apologize to leeks and to change their mind publicly about rice, which we need to discuss.
We do. We should talk about that, yeah.
Because you were bad-mouthing rice on an industrial scale.
It just wasn't for me. It's still largely not for me. I prefer literally every other type of legume or grain to rice. I just do. But I've come around being like, okay, once in a while I do like rice. But it's just not my go-to. It's not my number one.
That you'd say, this is how I want to spend my evening. I want to, you know, talk shit about food and about, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this is why I found this book so appealing on first touch, on first go.
Yeah.
The recipes are excellent.
Thanks.
The recipes are so good. The date and lemon chicken, which we cooked for you tonight, this is the second time we're doing it.
Oh, great.
Because we cooked it already. Frazzled chickpeas, you've done that.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, this book is like 90% anchovies. It must be so.
I wanted it to be 100, and they weren't
they
having
said,
that.
We need to have three recipes.
And there were a few places where I was like, should I take them out of this?
Yeah.
I was like, no, I can't. Nah. There's a few places that aren't, they're optional, though, because I was like, well, or I just mention it casually in the head note, like, you could add anchovies. But just because I didn't want to seem like that's all I talk about. But I talk about it a lot.
But it is.
Yeah, it is.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah. Just to go back to the recipes, I was actually quite surprised to hear that you're a trained professional chef, because this feels like a home.
You're like, because this book is garbage.
No, because because of that tone, because of that friendly note, because of the unfussy, you know, vibe of it all, it feels like, yeah, come on in. It feels easy and approachable. But actually, there's a lot of kitchen smarts here.
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk about the reverse sear. Did I have it correctly?
Oh, yeah.
What's it called? How do I say it? The
reverse sear, yeah.
Yeah. The reverse sear is genius.
It's very chefy in a way that nothing else is. But I think that as soon as you take that label off of something, you can just be like, isn't this a fun, smart way to do something that's going to make your life easier? Rather than be like, this is the only way you should ever do something because I'm a chef and I say so.
Yeah.
It seems aggressive. But if you are just posing it as like, this is going to... You won't be able to mess this up.
Can you tell these guys about the reverse sear?
Yeah, it's basically what it sounds like. You sear it in reverse. No. So it's for any large hunk of meat. I do this with leg of lamb, with a standing rib roast. Any kind of cut of meat that you want to be really nicely rare on the inside and really browned on the outside, cook it at first at a really low and slow temperature. It's not unlike how most restaurants will do it in like sous vide or something like that. But obviously, I don't have that. And I wouldn't ask you to get one either. So I just do it in the oven at a really low temperature to make sure that it's, you know, at the temp you want, the perfect rareness, and then either sear it in a skillet or turn your oven up to the highest it will go, and then to brown that fat cap on the outside.
Because it's, you know, this is like when you want to serve rare meat or pink or medium rare, when people come over, then you say like, oh, yeah, I need my frying pan, then it gets smoky.
Well, also, I feel like when you do it, like take a rib roast or something, or in like a lamb where it's very fatty on the outside, I used to always start them super high. Like brown it first and then roast it low and slow. But what I was realizing is, especially if you're rubbing it with something, it's really nice to give those ingredients an opportunity to like get to know the meat. So if it's in there for about an hour and a half, 2 hours, which it is upwards of because it takes a while, there's no chance it's going to overcook because it's such a large hunk of meat at such a low temperature. But also during that time, whatever marinade or spice mixture or salt even that you put on it is going to have more time with it before you blast it off like with super high heat, which can like burn spices or herbs or thing or anchovies. You know, doing it and also that fat cap is going to start to render, meaning you have less of that like charred fat cap on the outside with the thick fat cap on the underside and then the rare meat. You have like a more even, you know, crusty bit to nice fat to rare meat.
Yeah.
I could draw a diagram if you guys give me a piece of paper or something.
No, but you don't need to because it makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
I do it
on the grill too, that way. I'll build like a 2-zone fire and then just put the meat super low and slow and like basically forget about it, knowing that there's no chance it's going to overcook, and then hit it on the grill really high at the end. So good.
The other thing that I love about this book is these kind of non-recipes, entertaining ideas that you just, or not entertaining, I'm sorry. We don't
use that word here.
We don't use that word because it's not the 50s, but... But I love that you write that as well about, you know, your grandma carving the crudités and
she's so funny. Yeah, they're like, your grandmother must have been a great cook to go through all that trouble, and horrible cook. I think she was sort of disguising how bad she was by the smoke show of like a carved crudité platter, like turning radishes into animals, and like, oh, you must be really good in the kitchen. It's like more of an arts and crafts move than it is a culinary move, but you know.
I love these kind of really easy things that you wouldn't necessarily think about, but are just so, you know, cook friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So do you cook at home now?
After
years of shopping?
I do, but mostly in this capacity. So with all my books, I do my recipe testing at home in my kitchen. And the easiest way for me to do that is by having people over. And so when it came time for me to kind of have this, I had to, you know, formally pitch the idea for the second book. I was like, I'm just going to do what I do, which is have people over. Because that's how I live my life. That's how I recipe test. I rarely, if not never, cook for myself alone. Like, I'm never just, like, whipping up some chicken thighs or, like, a pan of chickpeas. Like, if I'm cooking alone and it's just me at home, I'm making popcorn or something. Like, I'm making toast with, like, a sardine can. Like, I'm not doing anything special or worth writing home about. But when I have people over, that's when I want to actually cook things. It's an act of itself to spend the time getting ingredients and sourcing it and cooking it, and that is really exciting to me. And there is nothing worse than me doing all of that and having no one there to eat it with me. Not to be like, oh, boo-hoo, I'm alone, but more just like the reason to cook is to feed other people. And I also am a very social person who hates going out. So I love to have you over because I don't want to leave my house, but I do want to be social.
And you don't want to like be so full, a little bit drunk, and then schlep all the way home.
No, I don't have to go anywhere afterwards.
People,
I wanna,
you go away and I'm going to bed now.
Yeah, I take my pants off and like crawl in a bed and that's it. That's that.
Yeah, and then wake up to like a disgusting house full of...
Yeah, basically. My friends are actually quite good. They will almost always do the dishes. It's a select group of people that I'm speaking to, but they are, without even asking, with no grudge, they will always take care of the dishes.
You have trained them well.
I know. Well, they also know they're never going to invite me over to their house. They're never going to cook. They're never, you know, so it's the least they can do.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit of a special recipe from this book that you love more than anyone or that I didn't notice and that you want to talk about.
That you didn't notice?
Yeah.
Gosh. Well, that chicken is one of my favorites, but you already talked about it.
Yeah. Let's talk about the this. Yeah.
Well,
we have the dip.
Yeah.
The
I feel
dip
like
is big.
All of these could be the this.
Yeah.
But I would say if I'm looking for one to become the, I would really love it to be, where are you, little friend? The cabbage. Because I love cabbage.
Nearly made it.
It's so good.
Do you know why you didn't get it? Because of the last line of the recipe, which you can read to the people.
What does it say?
In the duo head.
It says, this should be made right before you sit down to eat, which is to say, sorry, there are no duo heads here.
Yeah.
But that's because I want to manage people's expectations, and I want you to know that if I don't put a duo head in a recipe, it's because I truly don't believe that it's better.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
For it.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to do it ahead, but I'm telling you in advance that it's not going to be as good. But it also comes together in like 8 minutes. A friend told me last night that he had made this just as a side dish to a steak he was cooking, and he was like, it was so good. It was like a really fresh but also cooked Caesar salad. And I was like, oh, that is absolutely correct because there's anchovies in it. Surprise! This is an example of a dish that I was just making. A friend of mine were like upstate New York, and I was actually writing a lot of this book, and that's kind of how I write. That's my process. I have to literally get out of my apartment and go to a place where the Wi-Fi is bad and I don't know anybody for miles because otherwise I just have no self-discipline. And we were cooking dinner for just us two, and I went to the market and I had one lone little head of cabbage, and I was like, oh, I like cabbage. And so just off the cuff made this thing, and she was like, are you kidding me? This is the best thing I've ever eaten. I was like, it's just cabbage and some anchovies and butter. She's like, you have to put this in the book. I was like, well, it's a little late for that. I'm literally in the middle of writing it. And she's like, well, you have to do it. You have to put it in the book. And so I did. But it is truly, truly so good. And one of the dishes that I make quite often, or a variation of, which is like, when I had first cooked it, I seared some pork chops in a skillet and then used the leftover pork fat to sear the cabbage in that, and then just finished it with a knob of butter, melted some anchovies in that, took it off the heat really quickly, and then finished it with lemon. So the cabbage is like just kind of cooked and caramelized on the outside, but still stays pretty crunchy on the inside. It's just really good. I love it so much. And I just think that cabbage, people are like, oh, cabbage. But for me, I'm like, cabbage. It feels exciting to me. It's a really good vegetable.
It is. It's really good and very...
It might be different here, though. Is that different? Do you guys love cabbage?
We get stunning cabbage. It's one of the nicest things that you get, and actually all year round.
Well, I'm here to tell you that this cabbage is a delight.
It's really, you know, we were hooked on it.
Okay.
And we said we're going to make this, but we didn't want to get in trouble.
No. Oh, you mean tonight you were going to make it?
Yeah, because we cook it all in the shops, and we hot hold it. So
the
do-ahead is the fans of Alice and Roman are romantics, as we like to call ourselves. TM.
Wait, where did you hear this? Where did you hear this? Because someone just told me this.
I just came up with it.
No, someone else had come up with it.
Witnesses, I just came up with it in my head. Romantics.
I had recently just heard this from somebody else, and I was like, no one says that. But what if they are? What if
it's
you are saying it?
It's a thing. Trademark, Louisa. Trademark. Yeah.
Well, we have an audio recording of this now.
We need to get
that Instagram
account.
You can file the paperwork.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is. It's been so fun and lovely, and I think that what's nice about it for me is that it's not just people sort of like following someone on Instagram or something, which requires very little on you, on your behalf. Like, you click a thing and whatever, who cares? But people are like spending their money on buying a book, and then they're spending their own money on buying ingredients, and then their time cooking recipes and actually documenting them. It's a total commitment. Yeah. And that to me is so fulfilling and makes me feel so good that the time and commitment that I've put into this is being completely reciprocated by everybody that participates in these recipes. And that's why I think, you know, seeing it on Instagram and it doesn't feel like an empty experience for me. It feels actually super rich and fulfilling. And I'm pretty sure that's the only time anyone said that about social media ever. So,
like I said before, you do feel like you're spending time with a friend, with a close friend, or with kind of your ideal imaginary friend. How does it feel like to be an imaginary friend of someone?
I know, we'll have
people
to like make a doll of me and we'll start selling it. No, yeah. I'm just kidding, I would never do that. That's so creepy. Yeah, I don't know. It feels good. And
do you find it odd with people's reactions saying, oh yeah, let's talk about leaks,
no,
or let's apologize to Rice?
No, I feel like if it's striking a chord with you, I feel like then we've all read something that somebody has written and been like, oh, yes, somebody finally said it. And I feel that way constantly with people, even outside of the food space, especially outside the food space. But it feels really nice to feel connected to somebody else and be like, oh, that person also has had that thought. That's great. And I feel close to them, even though we've never met. And I feel like that happens often in films and in movies and different things.
Both, just kidding.
I meant films.
Both these,
and
media, yeah.
Films and music. You know, like the first time you listen to an album and like the lyrics like speak to you about a breakup you had, and you're like, oh, that person gets me. You know, I feel like it's the same thing when you're like, I also love cabbage, you know? So I feel like it's a similar
I have also
thing.
Wronged leaks.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Oh, I wish I had a backlog. Yeah, I feel like I work pretty much how I live my life, which is completely last minute at all times. I don't think that much ahead for anything that I do, and that includes recipes. And I think for things like books, with Dining In, it was a bit different because it was my first book, so I had my whole life of ideas and recipes and techniques that I was like, well, this is my first book and this is my introduction to the world and here's what I'm going to put in this book. And it was recipes and ideas that had gone back years or weeks or months or whatever. And so with Nothing Fancy, it was a bit different because I had a year. I had 12 months to kind of refresh and replenish my inspiration. But because it had, to me, such a better focus, or more of a focus rather, it was to serve a purpose. Like, these are recipes for having people over. It was easier for me to kind of come up with that table of contents. And with something like, say, the New York Times, that is seasonal, right? So I'm shooting and developing six recipes at a time. And I know that that's going to run from March to mid-April, you know? So I know that it's going to be cold and there's not going to be much produce. So it feels like I'm solving a problem for that time. So I think that if you were to tell me, you can come make me a book that's 20 recipes of just anything, whatever, that would be very challenging for me, because how do you do that? But if you say, give me 20 recipes that you can all make with under $20 and it's winter, like, that would be great. I would nail it. So I think that inspiration and those ideas, it's not like I have a bottomless well. I mean, at least I don't know if I do, because I haven't tapped it yet, but I feel like thus far I'm working a little bit at a time, and within each project find it easy. I was almost nervous about Nothing Fancy feeling too similar to Dining In, because my palette and my style didn't really evolve that much in that year. But why? And then I was like, well, why would it? I'm the same person. I think the writing evolved and the photography and the styling of it, but my flavor profiles kind of remain the same. I love spicy food. I love lemons. I love anchovies. And I probably never won't. You're not going to pick up a book one day and be like, all of a sudden this woman loves peanut butter. Like, not going to happen.
Well,
it's fine. Oh, I don't dislike peanut butter. I'm just saying.
No, but there is a recipe for rice here. I mean,
And I talk about it. I'm like, and I've said I didn't like it. And now here's one. So people are allowed to grow and change.
So my question to you is, which one of your recipes would you describe yourself as and why?
Oh my God, that is such a good question.
It's an amazing
question. No, that I will say, in all of the questions I have ever been asked by anybody, that is probably the best question I've ever been asked.
It is the best question.
Oh
my God. Well, now we can listen to it on this podcast. I'm going to go ahead and say that it's probably this cover chicken with the anchovies added. the optional anchovies. Because to me, it is like the ultimate expression of like, looks impressive, but is like actually kind of just a big old mess. Or like easier than you think. Or like, I'm all about like under promise, over deliver. You know, if you're like, oh, put a chicken in a dish, scatter some tomatoes around and like put it in the oven, hope for the best. You're going to be like, well, that doesn't sound that exciting. But when it comes out of the oven, you are so pumped because it is truly one of the most delicious chickens you can make. And I'm just a delicious chicken at the end of the day. It's like, you know, the most unfussy thing you can make, but is just so satisfying.
Thank you so much, Alison Roman. It's been such a delight. You are truly a kitchen friend. And for you guys, Alison Roman really is your friend. Not in the sense that you can come to her house because we will get a restraining order.
Yeah.
You cannot take bits of her hair. But Alison Roman is your friend in the sense that she wrote this lovely book for you guys to be with you in the kitchen, to drink some wine, to cook delicious food, to eat anchovies from the jar, lots of cheese. There's so much we didn't even discuss.
I know. Like the cheese and the cream. Which
the
people,
cheese and the... How did we not talk about cheese? Like 90% of this book.
There's not that much cheese in it. Come on.
But please, guys, please, let's all give a big hand from all us romantic PM to Alison Roman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to our latest episode. If you'd like to join one of the next talks, please follow us on social media at Honey & Co. or go on our website, honeyandco.co.uk. With a huge thanks to Hester Kant for producing.
A special thanks to our own Louisa Cornford for her wonderful research.
And the music is by the lovely Alice Russell. Thanks for listening.